The National Sunday Law, The Argument of A.T. Jones Before the U.S. Senate Committee, December 1888, Part 2. Senator Blair, the law was wrong, you say. Mr. Jones, certainly the law was wrong. The Roman law was that no man should have particular gods of his own, gods not recognized by the Roman law. Senator Blair, that law was not for the good of society? Mr. Jones, no, sir. Senator Blair, certainly it was not. Then you have to repeal the law or obey it. Mr. Jones, it ought to be repealed. Senator Blair, during these 1800 years, we have contrived to repeal that law. But here comes an intelligent people who have evolved among themselves as the result of 1,000 or 1,500 years of history, among other things, the institution of the Christian Sabbath by writing it in the laws of every state in this country, so that the whole American people, made up of communities or states, have enacted the principle of this law. Mr. Jones, the same principle is under the bill before the committee. There is the same principle under it all. If you can legislate in regard to the Sabbath, you can legislate in regard to blasphemy. You can legislate in regard to idolatry and every other offense against God, as did both the Puritan and the papal theocracy. Senator Blair, you deny the right of the majority, in other words, to make a law in conformity with which the whole shall practice in society? Mr. Jones, I deny the right of any civil government to make any law respecting anything that pertains to man's relationship to his God under the first four of the Ten Commandments. I wish right here to show further that this is not only the principle of the Word of Jesus Christ, but also of the American Constitution. Before Christianity was preached in the world, the Roman Empire had among its laws these statutes. Number one, no man shall have for himself particular gods of his own. No man shall worship by himself any new or foreign gods unless they are recognized by the public laws. Number two, worship the gods in all respects according to the laws of your country and compel others to do the same, but hate and punish those who would introduce anything whatever alien to our customs in this particular. Number three, whoever introduces new religions, the tendency and character of which are unknown, whereby the minds of men may be disturbed, shall, if belonging to the higher rank, be banished, if to the lower, punished with death. The Christians did have a particular God of their own, not recognized by the Roman law. They did introduce a new religion. The Roman Empire enforced the law. And that is why the Christians were put to death. If things pertaining to God be a proper subject of legislation by civil government, then no Christian was ever persecuted, and there has never been persecution in this world. All the Roman Empire did in killing Christians was to enforce the law. Then the question was with the Christians at that time, and the question is with us. Is not the law wrong? And did not the Christians have the right to attack the law? That is what they did. When a Christian was brought before the magistrate, a dialogue followed something like this. Magistrate, have you a particular God of your own, a God not recognized by the Roman law? Christian, yes. Magistrate, did you not know that the law is against it? Christian, yes. Magistrate, have you not introduced a new religion? Christian, yes. Magistrate, did you not know that the law is against it? Christian, yes. Magistrate, did you not know that the penalty is death for those of lower ranks? Christian, yes. Magistrate, you are of the lower ranks? Christian, yes. Magistrate, you have introduced a new religion? Christian, yes. Magistrate, you have a God of your own? Christian, yes. Magistrate, what is the penalty? Christian, death. That was all. The Romans enforced the law upon the Christians in the first days of Christianity, and there was no persecution in it if the principle be recognized that civil government has a right to legislate in religious things. The empire had this apparent advantage too, that the law existed before Christianity was known in the world. Christianity appeared to Rome as nothing else than an uprising against the imperial power. Laws are made to be enforced, and to enforce the law is all that the Roman Empire ever did, whether up to the time of Constantine or at any other time. In fact, all the papacy did in the Middle Ages was to have the emperors enforce the law. We stand today just where the Christians did at that time. We come to the root of the whole matter and deny the right of the civil government to legislate on anything that pertains to our duties to God under the first four commandments, and assert the Christian and American principle that every man has the right to worship God according to the dictates of his own conscience. The principle that the Christians asserted was to render to Caesar that which is Caesar's and to deny the right of Caesar to demand anything that pertains to God. They gave their lives in support of that principle against the law of the Roman Empire and against the very existence of the Roman Empire. This principle was asserted and maintained until it forced the Roman Empire with all its power to recognize the right of every man to have a particular God of his own and to worship that God as he chose. The Roman Empire did come in the days of Constantine and Licinius to that point. At the death of Galerius, it was decreed in the Roman law by the emperors Constantine and Licinius in the Edict of Milan that every man should be at liberty to have any god he pleased and worship him as he pleased. It was the Christian principle that forced the Roman Empire to that point in the face of all its laws and institutions of ages. Our national constitution embodies the very principle announced by Jesus Christ, that the civil government shall have nothing to do with religion or with what pertains to God, but shall leave that to every man's conscience and his God. And as long as he is a good citizen, the nation will protect him and leave him perfectly free to worship whom he pleases, when he pleases, as he pleases, or not to worship at all if he pleases. In Article 6 of the Constitution of the United States, this nation says that, quote, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States, close quote. By an amendment making more certain the adoption of the principle, it declares in the First Amendment to the Constitution, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, close quote. This First Amendment was adopted in 1789 by the first Congress that ever met under the Constitution. In 1796, a treaty was made with Tripoli in which it was declared in Article 2 that, quote, the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, close quote. This treaty was framed by an ex-Congregationalist clergyman and was signed by President Washington. It was not out of disrespect to religion or Christianity that these clauses were placed in the Constitution and that this one was inserted in that treaty. On the contrary, it was entirely on the account of their respect for religion, and the Christian religion in particular, as being beyond the province of civil government, pertaining solely to the conscience, and resting entirely between the individual and God. This fact is so well stated by Mr. Bancroft in his History of the Constitution of the United States that I will here insert it. Quote, "In the earliest states known to history, government and religion were one and indivisible. Each state had its special deity, and often these protectors, one after another, might be overthrown in battle, never to rise again. The Peloponnesians' War grew out of a strife about an oracle. Rome, as it sometimes adopted into citizenship those whom it vanquished, introduced in like manner, and with good logic, for that day the worship of their gods. No one thought of vindicating religion for the conscience of the individual till a voice in Judea, breaking day for the greatest epoch in the life of humanity by establishing a pure, spiritual, and universal religion for all mankind, enjoined to render to Caesar only that which is Caesar's. The rule was upheld during the infancy of the gospel for all men. No sooner was this religion adopted by the chief of the Roman Empire than it was shorn of its character of universality and enthralled by an unholy connection with the unholy state, and so it continued to the new nation, the least defiled with the barren scoffings of the 18th century, the most general believer in Christianity of any people of that age, the chief heir of the Reformation in its purest forms, when it came to establish a government for the United States, refused to treat faith as a matter to be regulated by a corporate body or having a headship in a monarch or a state. In vindicating the right of individuality even in religion, and in religion above all, the new nation dared to set the example of accepting it in its relations to God, the principle first divinely ordained of God in Judea. It left the management of temporal things to the temporal power, but the American Constitution, in harmony with the people of several states, withheld from the federal government the power to invade the home of reason, the citadel of conscience, the sanctuary of the soul, and not from indifference, but that the infinite spirit of eternal truth might move in its freedom and purity and power." Close quote. Last chapter. At this point, I am brought to the assertion of the second of the principles upon which we stand in our opposition to Sunday laws or any other form of religious legislation, that is, the principle of the Constitution of the United States. And upon this principle, I maintain that this proposed Sunday law is unconstitutional. The object of this Sunday bill is wholly religious. The last section shows the object of the entire bill, and that is, quote, "to secure to the whole people rest and the religious observance of the Sabbath day," close quote. No one, therefore, need attempt to evade the force of objections against this bill by saying that it is not the religious, but the civil observance of the day that is required, because it is plainly declared in the bill itself that it is not only to secure rest to all people, but that it is also to secure the religious observance of the Sabbath day. There is not a single reference in the bill to any such thing as the civil observance of the day. The word civil is not used in the bill. It is a religious bill wholly. The title of the bill declares that its object is to secure to the people the enjoyment of the Lord's Day as a day of rest, and to promote its observance as a day of religious worship. The first section defines the Lord's Day. The second section refers to the day as one of worship and rest. The third section refers to it as a day of religious worship. The fourth section refers to his observance as that of religious worship. And the sixth section plainly declares, what is apparent throughout, that the object of the bill is to secure to the whole people rest and the religious observance of the Sabbath day on the first day of the week. It is the religious observance of the day that it promotes from one end of the land to the other have in view. In the convention, now in session in this city, working in behalf of this bill, only yesterday Dr. Crafts said, quote, "Taking religion out of the day takes the rest out," close quote. In the Boston Monday Lectures, 1887, Joseph Cook, lecturing on the subject of Sunday laws, said, quote, "The experience of centuries shows, however, that you will win in vain endeavor to preserve Sunday as a day of rest unless you preserve it as a day of worship. Unless Sabbath observance be founded upon religious reasons, you will not long maintain it at a high standard on the basis of economic and physiological and political considerations only," close quote. And in the Illinois State Sunday Convention, held in Elgin, November 8, 1887, Dr. W.W. Everts declared Sunday to be the test of all religion, close quote. Sunday is a religious institution wholly. Sunday legislation, wherever found, is a religious legislation solely. And this bill does not, in its terms, pretend to be anything else than religious. Being, therefore, as it is, religious legislation, it is clearly unconstitutional. In proof of this, I submit the following considerations. All the powers of Congress are delegated powers. It has no other power. It cannot exercise any other. Article 10 of the Amendments of the Constitution expressly declares that, quote, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people," close quote. In all the powers thus delegated to Congress, there is no hint of any power to legislate upon any religious question or in any regard to the observance of any religious institution or right. Therefore, this Sunday bill, being a religious bill, is unconstitutional, and any legislation with regard to it will be unconstitutional. Sunday being a religious institution, any legislation by Congress in regard to its observance will be unconstitutional as long as the United States Constitution shall remain as it is now. Nor is this all. The nation has not been left in doubt as to whether the failure to delegate this power was or was not intentional. The First Amendment to the Constitution, in declaring that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, shows that the failure to delegate such power was intentional and makes the intention emphatic by absolutely prohibiting Congress from exercising any power with regard to religion. It is impossible to frame a law on the subject of religion that will not prohibit the free exercise of religion. Therefore, the First Amendment to the Constitution absolutely prohibits Congress from ever making any law with regard to any religious subject or the observance of any religious rite or institution. More than this, the National Reform Association knows and has been contending for 25 years that for Congress to make any Sunday law would be unconstitutional. Yet the National Reform Association is one of the most prominent agencies in urging forward this bill. And the secretary of that association stood at this table today to plead for its passage. And this only shows that they are willingly, knowingly, to resort to unconstitutional means to secure their coveted power and to establish their purposes. As for Dr. Crafts and his fellow workers, whether or not they know it to be unconstitutional, we do not know. In the announcements of the National Sunday Law Convention now, December 11 to 13, 1888, being held in this city, it was stated that the church in which the convention was to meet would be festooned with the names of 6 millions of petitioners, but at the beginning of the first meeting, it was stated that there were 14 millions of them. A question was sent up asking how the number could have grown so large so suddenly. Mrs. Bateman was recalled to the platform to answer the question, and when she answered it, the cause of such a sudden and enormous growth was explained by the fact that Cardinal Gibbons had written a letter endorsing the bill, and solely upon the strength of his name, 7,200,000 Catholics were counted as petitioners. This was not a complete answer to the question because the cardinal's letter does not authorize any such use of it as they have made, at least so much of it as was made public does not. The whole of the letter was not made public there because Dr. Crafts says it was for the Senate committee. It was laid on the table here today. But so much of it as was read merely referred to the action of the Baltimore Council in commanding a stricter observance of Sunday and said, quote, "I am most happy to add my name to those of the millions of others who are laudably contending against the violation of the Christian Sabbath by unnecessary labor and who are endeavoring to promote its decent and proper observance by judicious legislation," close quote. That was all. He said, "I am happy to add my name, etc." He did not say that he added or that he wished to add 7,200,000 others with his name or in his name, yet this was done. But it was not so much to be wondered at because the same principle had been acted upon before throughout the country. And when 500 petitioners could be made out of 100 and 240,000 out of 240, it was perfectly easy and entirely consistent to make 7,200,000 and 1 out of 1. This thing was perfectly consistent also with the principle in another point. The petition reads, quote, "We, the undersigned, adult residents of the United States, 21 years of age or more, hereby petition," close quote, etc. In counting these 7,200,000 petitioners in behalf of the Sunday Law, they thereby certified that all these were Catholics, 21 years of age or more. But there was not a man in that convention, and there's not a woman in the Woman's Christian Temperance Union who does not know that there are not that many Catholics in the United States 21 years of age or more. They virtually certified that all the Catholics in the United States are 21 years of age or more, for they distinctly announced that all the Roman Catholics were petitioning for the Sunday Law. But as they had virtually certified the same thing of the Protestant churches throughout the country, why should they not go on and swing in all the Roman Catholics in the same way? They could do the one just as honestly as they could do the other. When men and women professing themselves to be Protestant Christians will do such things as that to carry the Catholic Church with them, it is not to be wondered at if they should be willing to resort to unconstitutional means to make their religious zeal effective in national law. Senator Blair. "Then you assume that this bill and all Sunday laws concern only the relation of man to God and not the relation of men to each other?" Mr. Jones. "Yes, sir. That is the principle upon which we stand." Senator Blair. "Right there, I find fault with your original proposition. You have got to establish, before you can defeat the ground of Sunday laws, that Sunday laws are not for the good of Caesar, that is, not for the good of society. Mr. Jones, I have not had time to prove that yet. I will prove fully that Sunday laws are not for the good of anybody. Senator Blair, come to the point as soon as you can. That is the point in this case, as between you and the law proposed to be enacted. Mr. Jones, very good. For the state to compel men to do no work is to enforce idleness. Idleness is the root of unlimited evil. It is a true proverb that we learned in our boyhood. Quote, Satan always finds something for idle hands to do, close quote. In this world, to compel men to be idle is to force them into a line of influences and temptations which in the very nature of things can end only in evil. It is well known, and it is one of the principal grounds of the complaints of those who are working for Sunday laws, that Sunday is, of all the week, the day of the most wickedness, that the record of crime and violence on Sunday exceeds that of any other day of the week, especially in large cities. Dr. Crafts refers constantly to London as an exemplary city in the matter of enforced Sunday laws, but the fact was brought out last spring by a member of this committee, Senator Payne, that the statement had lately been made on authority that London on Sunday is the most immoral and dissipated city in the world. Now, why is this? They argue that it is because the saloons are open on Sunday. But the saloons are open every other day of the week. Then the saloons being open no more on Sunday than on any other day, why is it that there is so much more violence done on Sunday than on other days of the week? It is because more men are idle on Sunday than on any other day of the week. Upon this point, I will quote an extract from the Cincinnati Commercial Gazette of March 10, 1888. Quote, they declare Sunday the moral ruin of the people. They prove it by alleged statistics of criminal prosecutions to show that more crimes of violence are committed on Sunday than on all other days of the week. Why is this? Because the saloons are open? They are open on other days. This reduces them to the sole reason that it is because it is a day of idleness. Their argument is absolutely destructive to the benefits of the custom of a rest day. They continually affirm that a Sabbath day is the very foundation of religion, morals, and society, and they as incessantly declare that the custom of Sunday cessation from work in the cities had made it a day of moral ruin. What is their recourse from the destruction which they charge upon the day of idleness? To make statutes more stringent to enforce idleness, arguing that idleness on that day leads mankind to moral ruin. They call for a more rigid enforcement of idleness to lead mankind to the ways of salvation. Surely there is need to revise their basis in season before they can proceed rationally in legislation. Selling beer is no more a sin on Sunday than on other days. The reason why more crimes of violence are done on Sunday than on the other days, if that is a fact, is not that the saloons are open, but that the men are idle. The good of a day of rest for the toilers has to be taken with the drawback of this unavoidable evil from idleness and indulgences of appetite. The cause is the cessation of vocations. Close quote. This argument is entirely sound. We submit to the consideration of any candid mind that it would be far better to allow men to follow their honest occupations on Sunday as they do on other days of the week than to compel them to be idle and thus forcibly throw them into the way of all the temptations and evil that beset men in this world. No state, therefore, can ever afford for its own good to enact laws making idleness compulsory, as Sunday laws do. More than this, to prohibit men from following their honest occupations at any time under penalties of fine or imprisonment, or perhaps both, is for the state to regulate honest occupations to the realm of crime and put a premium upon idleness and recklessness. It is well known that in many localities, if a man will only be idle on Sunday, he can run into all sorts of dissipation and wickedness to any extent except that of downright violence without any fear of prosecution or penalty of any kind. But if any quiet, industrious citizen chooses to engage in his honest occupation, going quietly about his own business on his own premises on Sunday, he is subjected to prosecution, to a penalty of a heavy fine, and perhaps imprisonment. This is nothing else than to put a premium upon wickedness. No state can afford to make crimes of honest occupations. No state can afford to put a premium upon idleness and all its attendant wickedness. All these complaints of evil and violence and wickedness on Sunday, so enlarged upon by the people who are working for Sunday laws, is an open confession that wickedness is the effect of enforced idleness. And this in itself is the strongest argument that can be offered against the very things for which they plead. The states of the Union have all these years been sowing the wind in this very thing, and now they are reaping the whirlwind. And worse than all, they propose to cure the evils of all this enforced idleness by more stringently enforcing more idleness throughout the whole nation and by the national power. It may be answered that this reflects upon the wisdom of God in appointing a day of rest, but it does not. God appointed the Sabbath for a purpose, and that purpose is that men should remember him in his works of creation and worship him as creator. The intention of the commandment enjoining the observance of the Sabbath day is the honor of God and his worship as creator. This worship and the religious sanctions which God has associated with the Sabbath are considerations which will ever prevent the day from becoming a day of idleness of those who keep the Sabbath in obedience to him and the worship of God, and the religious sanctions which he has put upon the Sabbath are the only things that ever can prevent the Sabbath from becoming a day of idleness. Those who advocate this Sunday bill well know this. This whole principle is embodied in that statement Dr. Crafts made to the Knights of Labor that, quote, if you take religion out of the day, you take the rest out, close quote. The same principle is also apparent in the words of Joseph Cook, before referred to, that you will in vain endeavor to secure the enforcement of a day of rest unless you enforce it as a day of worship, and unless it be founded on religious reasons, it cannot be long maintained. Thus, these men themselves confess the point which I here make, that it is only the religious sanctions and worship that can ever keep a day of rest from being a day of idleness and of consequence, wickedness. But it is only God who can furnish those sanctions. The state never can. Therefore, next step in the proceeding on the part of those who are calling for this law is to have the state attempt to supply the religious sanctions which belong with the day of rest, which only can keep it from being a day of idleness and a day of evil. But they know that the state has none of those religious sanctions, and they know that these will have to be supplied to the state by the church, and then the church will call upon the state by its power to force them upon the citizen. This is precisely what is proposed by Reverend Sam Small in a sermon in Kansas City last winter, expressed the views of many more than himself when he said, quote, I want to see the day come when the church shall be the arbiter of all legislation, state, national, and municipal, when the great churches of the country can come together harmoniously and issue their edict, and their legislative powers will respect it and enact it into laws, close quote. But any attempt to enforce religious observances only enforces hypocrisy and multiplies sin, because love for God is essential to every act of religious duty. For a man to tender obedience or homage to God when he has no love for God in his heart only dishonors God and does violence to his own nature. For anybody to obey God or perform religious observances from interested motives is sin. And for the state to exert its power in compelling men to act religiously and pretend to honor God when they have in the heart no love for God is only to force them into hypocrisy and to compel them to commit sin, which, increased and multiplied by the exertion of national power, can end only in ruin, and that speedily. For as Mr. Buckle has most forcibly expressed it, quote, "In this way, men are being constrained to mask their thoughts. There arises a habit of securing safety by falsehood and of purchasing impunity with deceit. In this way, fraud becomes a necessity of life. Insincerity is made a daily custom, and the whole tone of public feeling is vitiated, and the gross amount of vice and error fearfully increased." Close quote. Consequently, it is only at its own peril that the state can ever enforce the observance of a day of rest. More than this, for the state to allow itself to be dictated to by the church, as here proposed by Mr. Small, is to render the church superior to the civil power, which can end in nothing but a religious despotism, which is the worst of all despotisms. Thus, by every line of reasoning that can spring from the subject, it is demonstrated that for the state to fix a day of compulsory rest can only end in evil. Therefore, my proposition is proved that Sunday laws are not for the good of anybody. Further, as it is only the religious sanctions which surround a day of rest that can prevent it from being a day of idleness and consequently of evil, and as God only can supply these sanctions, it follows that to God only can Sabbath observance be rendered. He only can command it. He only can secure it. And being a duty which can be rendered only to God, we are brought again directly to the command of Jesus Christ to render unto God, not to Caesar, that which is God's, which clearly forbids the state to have anything to do with Sabbath observance. This whole line of argument is fully sustained by the Sabbath commandment itself. That commandment says, quote, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it." Close quote. Here are the reasons. First, he rested on the seventh day. Second, he blessed it and made it holy. "That you may become tired" is not given as a reason for doing no work on the seventh day. God does not say that on the seventh day you shall do no work, because if you should, you would overdo or break down your physical system. Nothing of the kind. Man's physical wants are not referred to in the commandment. It says, "Work 6 days because the Lord worked 6 days. Rest on the seventh day because the Lord rested on the seventh day. Keep that day holy because the Lord blessed it and made it holy. It is the Lord who is to be held in view. It is the Lord who is to be exalted. Therefore, the fourth commandment and its obligations have solely to do with man's relationship to God. It is not man's physical, but his spiritual needs that are held in view in the Sabbath commandment. It is intended to be a day in which to worship God, a day of holy remembrance of Him and of meditation upon His works. The day is to be kept holy. If it is not kept holy, it is not kept at all. When the state undertakes to demand the observance of the Sabbath or the Lord's Day, it demands of men that which does not belong to it, that which belongs only to God. When the state undertakes to secure the observance of the Sabbath, it undertakes that which to it is an impossible task, because holiness is not an attribute of civil government, nor has it either the power or the credentials to promote holiness, and has been already demonstrated all that it ever can do in any such effort is to enforce idleness and put a premium upon recklessness, which for its own welfare the state cannot afford to do. If the state undertakes to supply, from whatever source, the religious sanctions which alone can keep the day from being one of idleness, generating evil, it only enforces hypocrisy and increases sin. Therefore, I repeat, that by every logical consideration of the subject, I have sustained my proposition that Sunday laws are not for the good of anybody or anything in this world. Senator Blair, do you understand that this bill undertakes to make anybody worship God? Mr. Jones, yes, sir. I affirm that it does, and I will prove it by statements made by those who stood here today. But I have some other points to make first, and here I propose to introduce my historical argument. I want you all to see that in this way the papacy was made in the 4th century. I shall read all that I do read, perhaps, on this point from Neander's Church History, Volume 2, Professor Torre's edition, Boston, 1852. I can only refer to it by the page. As I've related, the Roman Empire was forced by the principles of Christ to recognize the right of every man to worship as he chose. This right was recognized in the Edict of Milan, A.D. 312. But liberty of conscience trembled in the balance but a moment. And then the bishopric, with that ambitious spirit that developed the papacy, took up the strain and carried forward that line of work which ended in the imperialist despotism of the Middle Ages. I want you to see just how that was done, and you will then have no difficulty in seeing the tendency of the present movement. Neander says, quote, "There had in fact arisen in the church a false theocratical theory, originating not in the essence of the gospel, but in the confusion of the religious constitutions of the Old and New Testaments, which brought along with it an unchristian opposition of the spiritual to the secular power, and which might easily result in the formation of the sacerdotal state, subordinating the secular to itself in a false and outward way," close quote, page 132. A theocratical theory of government tending to subordinate the secular to itself was the scheme. In other words, the church aimed to make the ecclesiastical power superior to the civil power. These theoretical bishops made themselves and their power a necessity to Constantine, who, in order to make sure of their support, became a political convert to the form of Christianity and made it the recognized religion of the empire. For, says Neander further, quote, "This theocratical theory was already the prevailing one in the time of Constantine, and the bishops voluntarily made themselves dependent on him by their disputes and by their determination to make use of the power of the state for the furtherance of their aims. Close quote. Out if that theoretical theory of government came, the papacy, which did subordinate the civil to the ecclesiastical power, and that same spirit is to be guarded against today in the United States as much as in any other country. I want you to see that there is a theocratical theory underlining this whole scheme. Mr. Bateman has said that the Woman's Christian Temperance Union started this movement a short time ago, and that they had worked it up. What is their aim in civil government? I quote from the monthly reading of the Woman's Christian Temperance Union of September 1886, a monthly reading for all the local unions throughout the country, the following, quote, "A true theocracy is yet to come, and the enthronement of Christ in law and lawmakers. Hence, I pray devoutly, as a Christian patriot, for the ballot in the hands of woman, and rejoice that the National Woman's Christian Temperance Union has so long championed this cause." Close quote. A theocratical theory, you see, is behind this movement and is again coming in to interfere in civil things, to establish a theocracy and to subordinate the civil power at last to the ecclesiastical. Senator Blair, do you think the question of giving the ballot to woman is a religious question? Mr. Jones, no. I only read this for the purpose of giving the proof that there is a theocratical theory underlining this, as there was that in the 4th century, so as to show the parallel. Senator Blair. But the parallel seems to imply that the extension of the suffrage to woman is by divine appointment and is the introduction of a theocratic form of government. Mr. Jones. Yes, they want the ballot so as to make a theocracy successful. Senator Blair. Therefore, you would be against woman's suffrage? Mr. Jones. I would be against woman's suffrage or any other kind of suffrage to establish a theocracy. Senator Blair. But that is not the question. It is possible these women have misstated their own idea there. Mr. Jones. No, because I have other proofs. Let me read them. Senator Palmer, do you suppose they intended there a practical theocracy? Mr. Jones, I do, sir. But let me read further, and you will get their own words. Senator Blair, if these women are trying to overthrow the institutions of the country and are about to establish a sacerdotal state, we ought to know it. Mr. Jones, that is true, and that is why I am speaking here. We want the nation to know it. Senator Blair, these women need looking after, I admit. Mr. Jones, they do in that respect, and there are many men concerned in the same business. Senator Blair, otherwise it would not be dangerous. Mr. Jones, it would be dangerous anyway. A theocratical theory of government is dangerous anywhere. It is anti-Christian as well as contrary to right and the principles of justice. Senator Blair, do you suppose that the government of heaven is a theocracy? Mr. Jones, yes, sir, but a civil government, a government of earth, is not. Senator Blair, then why is it dangerous? Mr. Jones, governments of earth are not dangerous when properly controlled. Senator Blair, they only say that a true theocracy is yet to come. A millennium is supposed to be coming. Perhaps they have reference to a millennium that we have not yet got, so they will wait some years before they get it. Mr. Jones, but I'm going to read what kind of laws they propose to make to bring in the millennium. Senator Blair, so far as you have read, you have not touched the question. For they say a true theocracy is yet to come, and it may be they are looking to the coming down of the New Jerusalem for the time of the new theocracy. Mr. Jones, no, because no true theocracy can ever come through civil laws or through politics or through the ballot. Senator Blair, that is not sure at all. Mr. Jones, it is by the scriptures. Senator Blair, I do not know. I have read the Bible several times, but go on. This is the end of part 2.